cases that are not suitable for young listeners, and there may also be some explicit language used. Listener discretion is advised. The love triangle is a familiar trope in true crime. It has been romanticized in popular culture so much that it's easy clickbait when we see it happen to real people, especially when it leads to murder. But a triangle is cheating. Cheating is depressingly common and devastating to real relationships. It's the worst kind of betrayal, a gut punch. And yet it's complicated, because for so many of us, the love we had doesn't just dissipate. The anger and pain doesn't automatically replace the connection you thought you shared. It's why we try to forgive the cheating, to save our relationship. Especially if you feel blindsided, you didn't see it coming. Despite your problems, you feel like you would have known if your partner had fallen out of love with you. The shock of the betrayal clouds your thinking. And for some people, marriage vows really are sacred. Adultery does not immediately mean divorce. How do you move forward if you choose forgiveness? Because we all know you're never really going to forget. Some people seek counseling or find solace in their faith. Or they are able to compartmentalize the pain because their partner assures them that it's over. The betrayal is reduced to a sexual transgression, something a loving relationship can overcome. And maybe it can, but not if the cheater is still hiding something or someone. Sooner or later, the truth will come out. Welcome to episode 115, The Desperate Housewife and the Closet Killer. Brentwood, Tennessee is a suburb of Nashville, known for its upscale neighborhoods, rolling hills, and wealthy residents. The area is home to many different celebrities, from country musicians to NFL stars to actors and actresses. The suburb of Brentwood is close enough to Nashville to have a big city feel, but suburban enough to be reminiscent of shows like Desperate Housewives, a show that would seemingly inspire one resident more deeply than usual. I gave you a history of Brentwood in my very first episode. It is famous for being one of the wealthiest cities in America, located in Williamson County, which is in the top 10 of the richest counties in America. The population of Brentwood hovers around 40,000 and is predominantly white, with about 90% of residents being Caucasian and less than 2% being Black. Asian Americans represent about 7% of Brentwood, with less than 2% of citizens being Hispanic and other ethnic origins. Native Americans represent 0.09% of citizens today, even though they were the earliest known people in the area and lived there the longest. Native Americans of Mississippian culture lived there for about 500 years, from the 13th to the early 17th century. While there are no written records of these people, their burial mounds and artifacts provide a small glimpse into their way of life and experiences. However, there is no clue as to why they left the region. It remains a mystery. By 1760, this area of Middle Tennessee was home to many of the Cherokee, before English and French explorers began to encroach on their hunting grounds, and the groups fought over the land in a war of dominance. During the Revolutionary War, members of the militia were provided with pieces of land in the military district, a stretch of land encompassing Nashville and its surrounding areas. When the war was over, many of these men settled in the area that is now Brentwood. Many of Brentwood's men fought for the Confederacy during the Civil War. The effects of the war damaged the economy in the area and left many crops ruined. Following the Civil War, many formerly enslaved Black people established homes and a community in the area of Church Street, a part of the village of Brentwood that was called the Hard Scuffle Community. The area existed as a safe and thriving community for Black Americans until the 1960s, when the new interstate was built through the middle of the Hard Scuffle Community. The area once owned and lived on by the Mississippian Native Americans for around 500 centuries, and then former enslaved Americans for almost a century, is now home to one of the oldest and one of the wealthiest subdivisions in Brentwood, named Meadow Lake. Meadow Lake Subdivision is located next to the Brentwood Country Club and is home to mansions worth millions. The Brentwood Library and the Boiling Spring Academy and several other large and upscale subdivisions make up what's left of the area, including the Mountain View neighborhood. Technically, Mountain View has a Nashville zip code, but it's so close to Brentwood and is definitely part of the white and wealthy demographics in that area. April 11th, 2005 was an average spring day in the upscale Mountain View neighborhood, another subdivision filled with million-dollar mansions. Mountain View resident Regine Beverly was going about her usual Monday afternoon routine at her home when she was startled by someone banging on her front door at around 4 p.m. When she opened the door, she was met with the image of her distraught neighbor, 40-year-old Martha Freeman. According to Regine, Martha shuffled past her into the house without looking at her and said, "A man has killed my husband." Regine panicked. She asked Martha if she had called 911 yet, to which Martha answered no. So Regine picked up the phone to call 911 herself. She told the operator that her neighbor's husband had been murdered and that she suspected someone was still in the home. Police arrived on the scene within minutes, having been informed by dispatch that Martha Freeman had escaped the house, but a man armed with a shotgun was still inside. A SWAT team was put in place along the exterior. As they entered the home, police were unable to find a man wielding a weapon or any other person at all. That is, until they reached a bathroom off the side of the home's master bedroom. In the bathroom, on the floor, they found the body of 44-year-old Jeffrey Freeman, Martha's husband. I'm going to pause now for a short commercial break. Martha and Jeffrey Freeman were married at the Nashville courthouse in March of 1994 after a whirlwind romance. According to friends of the couple, they had met just a few months earlier, but they had a lot in common. Jeff and Martha both had a great sense of humor. They loved to travel, and they both had successful careers. The couple met after Martha had moved to Nashville from her hometown of Bowling Green and started working in sales at the local newspaper, The Tennessean, in late 1993. Martha Ann Cockhill Freeman was born in January of 1964, and her family owned a restaurant in Bowling Green. Jeffrey Allen Freeman was born in September of 1960 in Bristol, Tennessee. Jeff ran a successful trucking company in Nashville when he met Martha. The new couple were doing well financially, so much so that just weeks after their marriage, they purchased their first home together, a large two-story house in the exclusive neighborhood of Mountain View. Their combined financial success gave Martha the opportunity to start her own business. She quit her job at the Tennessean and studied to get a private investigator's license. Once she got her license, Martha started her business called Resifax, which provided background checks, credit history evaluations, and verified renting history to businesses and landlords. She initially ran her small company out of a spare bedroom in her Mountain View home. It wasn't long before Martha's business expanded, and she eventually hired two employees, Tony and Tara Cantrell, to assist with the workload. As the business grew, Martha moved her operation into an office space. In 2003, Jeff quit his job and joined the Resifax team. But it was around this time that Martha began to struggle with her mental health. She told friends and her employees that she didn't feel like herself and began falling into a depression. Martha began withdrawing from her business. To make up for her absence, Jeff spent more time at the office and took on more responsibility at Resifax. As her mental health worsened, Jeff encouraged his wife to seek treatment, and in 2004, she was diagnosed with bipolar disorder. After getting this diagnosis, Martha told friends she was happy to finally have an explanation for some of the feelings and emotions she had been experiencing. Not long after her diagnosis, Martha took more time off of work and began to focus on her mother, who was diabetic and in poor health. As her mother's health deteriorated, Martha and Jeff moved her into their spare bedroom so that Martha could take care of her full time. Having her mom at home and someone to care for seemed to provide Martha with a new sense of purpose, and her loved ones noticed an improvement in her disposition and attitude. This change in Martha's outlook, however, was short-lived. Just a year after she moved her mom into the Freeman home, her mother passed suddenly and without warning. The loss of her mother sent Martha spiraling into a depressive episode. She was heavily medicated and began to isolate herself within the home she shared with Jeff. Spending most of her time in the spare bedroom where her mom had rested the last few months of her life. Jeff had to work a lot of overtime to make sure the business was running smoothly. Even with his additional time at work, he continued to try to help his wife get better. His friend said in an interview for the Snapped episode on this case that Jeff, quote, was behind her 100%. He was supportive of his wife, but also somewhat private, telling employees and friends vaguely that Martha was doing fine, but not mentioning much else about her or their relationship. When he wasn't working, Jeff tried to coax Martha out of the house for small weekend trips like they used to enjoy together in the beginning of their relationship, usually without much success. To his delight, Jeff talked Martha into getting out of the house on the evening of the 4th of July in 2004. The couple left their Brentwood neighborhood and headed to downtown Nashville, roughly 10 miles away, to watch the annual fireworks show on the river. They had plans to explore the Broadway Strip downtown, walking around with the bustling crowds and bar crawlers before getting a hotel room and spending the night in the city. However, much to Martha's dismay, Jeff grew tired shortly after the fireworks display. He had worked a lot of hours that week and was no longer feeling up to staying downtown. He asked Martha if they could head home instead of checking into their hotel, and she refused. They argued, and Martha insisted on staying downtown as Jeff left to return home. This night profoundly changed the couple's 10-year marriage. Just a month later, in August of 2004, Martha moved out of their home and into an extended stay hotel called the Candlewood Suites. Martha told her employees and friends that she needed space and wanted time to find herself. I'm going to pause now to hear a word from today's sponsors. I am not a fan of grocery shopping or meal planning. That's why I love HelloFresh. They deliver fresh, pre-measured ingredients and mouth-watering seasonal recipes right to your door, contact-free. The recipes are easy to follow and quick to make, with steps and pictures to guide you along the way. You can still enjoy high-quality proteins and veggies while saving time and money, getting dinner on the table in 30 minutes or less. HelloFresh is 46% cheaper than shopping at the grocery store, and there's no worry of impulse buys or buying too much with HelloFresh's pre-portioned ingredients. HelloFresh offers 23 weekly recipes with a range of cuisines and ingredients, so you've always got something new to try. My husband and I are obsessed with the scallops over truffled mushroom risotto, and my teens love all the different kinds of beef and pork burgers there are to choose from. It's such a relief to have these delicious meals ready to grab and cook on hectic weeknights. Go to HelloFresh.com/SouthernFried10 and use the code SouthernFried10 for 10 free meals, including free shipping. That's HelloFresh.com/SouthernFried10 and use the promo code SouthernFried10 for 10 free meals with free shipping. Care of is a wellness brand where high quality meets personalization with a customized vitamin plan that helps you feel your best today and supports you long term. Care of uses clean ingredients backed by science with awesome transparency about their research. Your recommended Care of vitamins come in daily individually wrapped packets, perfect for keeping your routine simple. To get started, you take Care of's in-depth quiz, which asks you questions about your diet, lifestyle, and health conditions to determine your specific wellness goals. February isn't too late for a fresh start, and your resolutions don't have to be big. Small but impactful changes, like adding a daily vitamin to help support your energy, sleep, or fitness, can help you target your goals, whether they are short or long term. The online quiz only takes 5 minutes, and it asked me questions I may not have considered if I was trying to choose a vitamin for myself. I was recommended Rhodiola to help with my low energy at the end of the day. I often feel drained from stress and crave an afternoon nap. The Care of quiz reminded me of that and prioritized that issue in my personalized recommendations. I love the cute and convenient daily packets of vitamins. There's no need for a pill organizer to keep up with your Care of wellness plan. For 50% off your first Care of order, go to takecareof.com and enter code SFTC50. That's takecareof.com and enter code SFTC50 to get 50% off your first order. Although he was concerned for their relationship and marriage, Jeff understood and supported Martha's decision in hopes that the separation was temporary. He wanted his wife to get to a better place mentally and agreed that she needed this space. Since he was still working and supporting their finances, Jeff paid for the hotel and continued to go about his responsibilities, patiently waiting for his wife to return. Eventually, it came to the attention of Martha's employee, Tony Cantrell, that Martha's period of self-discovery was not taking place alone. She was shacking up with another man inside her hotel room. Martha had asked Tony to help run errands one day, and when he arrived at the hotel, he was introduced to Martha's new lover. She called the man Christian, but his real name was Rafael Rocha Perez, a 35-year-old undocumented man from Mexico. Tony Cantrell reported to the Snapped interviewers that he didn't think the man spoke any English, and Martha definitely did not speak Spanish, but they were clearly having a romantic affair. And all of this was on Jeffrey Freeman's dime, who was unaware that he was financing the relationship between his wife and her lover until 6 months after Martha had left their home and moved into the hotel. In January of 2005, Jeff headed to the hotel hoping to convince his wife to return to their home and life together and to break things off with Rafael. Jeff was still committed to his wife and did not want a divorce. Martha agreed to give the relationship another chance and asked her employee, Tony Cantrell, to meet her at the hotel so that she could break things off with the man she called Christian. She said she wanted Tony there as backup. According to Tony, the breakup went better than planned. The man just packed up his things and loaded them in Tony's truck. And then Tony drove Rafael to his actual residence in Murfreesboro, Tennessee. Martha moved back into the Mountain View home that she and Jeff had purchased within the first few weeks of their marriage, a time that now seemed so far away in the couple's history. Though she was back in their marital home, Martha and Jeff slept in different bedrooms. One morning, shortly after she had returned, Martha met her neighbor Regine at their mailboxes. She told Regine that things were going better in her life and relationship, and that she had found religion. 3 months later, on April 11th, 2005, 40-year-old Martha would again meet Regine, this time pounding on her door to say that her husband had been murdered. Based on the information from the 911 call from Regine, when investigators got to the scene, they worked from the theory that it was a home invasion turned deadly. Regine and Martha Freeman had been instructed to remain in Regine's home in case there was someone still in the Freeman house. But investigators quickly realized, after locating Jeffrey Freeman's body on the bathroom floor, that Martha's story didn't add up. The state of Jeff's body and the scene did not match up with the story that Martha had told her neighbor. Jeff was found on the floor of the master bathroom, zipped up in a sleeping bag. His head was wrapped in a plastic shopping bag, and he had multiple bruises across his body and face. It appeared he had been strangled, which his autopsy would later confirm. Jeff's wrists were bruised in a pattern indicating he had been bound for some time, but the rope or cord used to bind him had been removed and was no longer there. Even though Jeff's body was stiff and cold, and it was clear that he had been dead for a number of hours, the sleeping bag was wet, and the nearby tub was dry. Investigators escorted Martha outside of Raging Beverly's home and into a car to talk. She had no visible signs of an assault, and when asked to explain what happened, her story changed. She said she knew the man who had murdered her husband, but she didn't know where he had fled to. Martha provided investigators with a description of what the man had been wearing when he was in the home. According to court documents, a neighbor flagged down investigators still on the scene and said that she had seen a Hispanic male running from the area of the Freeman home into a nearby house that was under construction. According to this neighbor, the man had shoulder-length hair and was dressed in a maroon shirt and knee-length shorts. Officers entered the home under construction and found a man who appeared to be asleep in the rafters. The man fit the description Martha had provided. As the officers brought him back to the scene, Martha reportedly exclaimed, "That's the man who killed my husband." But police later said the man had no reaction and didn't even look at Martha. As the suspect was taken into custody, Tony Cantrell arrived on the scene. He was supposed to finish some work at the Freeman house, and he told investigators that he recognized the man in the back of the squad car, that Martha had identified as her husband's killer. The man was Martha's lover, 35-year-old Rafael Rocha Perez. Born in Mexico, on December 24th in 1969, Rafael was 5 years younger than Martha. Tony told the officers about the affair that Martha had supposedly ended back in January. Rocha Perez was booked that evening and refused to make any type of statement, but when police brought Martha in for questioning, she unraveled quickly. She explained to investigators that after Jeff left her downtown alone to return to their home on the night of the 4th of July, Martha had checked into the hotel and started drinking. She said she then walked the downtown strip by herself for a while and ran into Rocha Perez, who was hanging out with two of his friends. She said she invited the trio of strangers back to her hotel to drink and party. Following that night, Rafael began staying in Martha's hotel room with her as they began an intimate relationship. Martha explained how in early January, she and Jeff had agreed to work on their relationship, and she broke off the affair with Rafael Rocha Perez and moved back in. But according to Martha, the breakup didn't last long. By March, she snuck Rafael into her home and set up a makeshift bed in her bedroom's 2x8-foot closet, fit with a foam mat and bedding. According to the Tennessean, Rocha Perez would roam the house and do as he pleased during the day, including watching TV, playing video games, and eating, all while Jeff was hard at work at the Resifax office. At night, he would retreat into the closet and sleep. According to Martha, the pair would use an electronic device to speak to each other covertly, a device that translated English and Spanish. This strange arrangement was successfully hidden from Jeff until the night of his murder. Jeffrey Freeman arrived home from work on the night of Sunday, April 10th, 2005. According to Martha, as he reached the top of the stairs on the way to his room, he woke Martha up in a panic. He had heard snoring as he headed up the stairs, and he knew it wasn't coming from his soundly sleeping wife. He opened the closet door to reveal Rocha Perez, who had woken up when he heard Jeff talking. Jeff was in disbelief, and Martha told investigators that he had said he was going for a walk and expected Rocha Perez to be gone by the time he returned. But Rafael refused to leave, and when Jeff got back, he threatened to call the police. Martha said that when Jeff mentioned the police, Rafael became enraged. He grabbed a gun from the room and grabbed Jeff by his collar. Then he dragged him down the hall as Jeff pleaded with Martha to tell his parents that he loved them. As she recalled this moment, the rather cold-seeming Martha began to dramatically cry. She said Rafael closed the door to the bathroom, and then she heard the sounds of a commotion, splashing water and thumping, before it suddenly ended. Martha claimed that Rafael then exited the bathroom and said to her, quote, "No mas, nada." Martha claimed she spent hours kneeling over her husband's body in fear and disbelief as her lover cleaned up the scene. The cops chose not to press any charges against Martha, believing that she had been too scared to call for help and too stunned to alert authorities right away. They then released the now widowed Martha Freeman. Crime scene investigators combed the Freeman house for evidence that would back up Martha's claims. They found the closet with the makeshift bed. On the bed sat a couple of Spanish magazines and personal items belonging to Rafael. They also found a bag inside the home that contained women's lingerie, sex toys, and an erotic book. According to court documents, the bag also contained a receipt from a hotel and a Polaroid photo of Rafael Perez in the nude. Other pieces of evidence recovered in the home also matched Martha's story, including a shotgun propped up in another bedroom. They found trash bags and a wet pillowcase, along with a beach towel that was spread onto the floor of the living room. It was initially believed that the towel was used in the cleanup. Investigators also looked into emails that Martha had written through the six-month separation from her husband when she was living at the hotel. In one email from February of 2005, reported by the Tennessean, Martha explained to one of her neighbors, quote, "I have been seeing a psychiatrist for the past year. I've been on a dazzling array of meds that have almost rendered me disabled. In other words, I've had a hard time holding a full-time job because it's difficult to simply wake up some days due to the strong bipolar meds." In another email, Martha mentioned the six-month separation from Jeff and admitted that it had been good for her in some ways, but that it had ruined her financially. Also within these emails, investigators saw that Martha often compared her Mountain View suburb to the neighborhood from Desperate Housewives, Wisteria Lane. On April 15th, 4 days after Jeffrey Freeman's body was discovered by police, Martha took the stand at Rafael Rocha Perez's arraignment. It was the first time they had seen each other since the murder, as Rocha Perez was held in jail due to his undocumented status. The courtroom was silent as Martha detailed the events leading up to Rafael hiding away in her closet, and slowly her story on the stand began to unravel. Martha claimed she met Rafael on Broadway following the 4th of July fireworks as he was celebrating with two other friends. She explained to the courtroom that she invited Rafael and his friends to come back to her hotel room to party. Martha's demeanor remained calm as she casually testified that she had sex with all three of the men, shocking the courtroom. Rafael's attorney began to press Martha on the details of the night of the murder, including why it had taken her almost 18 hours to alert anyone about the situation or her husband's murder. Investigators believed that the window of death was between 10 p.m. on Sunday night and 5 a.m. on Monday morning, and yet Martha had not run to Regine's house until the late afternoon that Monday. According to the Tennessean, Martha replied to the question by saying that she simply didn't have an answer as to why she didn't call 911 sooner, prompting the judge to stop her in the middle of her testimony. In an unexpected turn of events, Judge Casey Moreland said, quote, "It's so bizarre. It's hard to believe a lot of this. I have problems with allowing this to go further without her getting some representation. and I can see her being charged in this case. She probably should be charged in this case. I hope the state does not believe everything she is testifying to, because I sure don't. Then he adjourned for a short break. When they returned, Martha invoked the Fifth Amendment and refused to answer any more questions. In fear that Martha was implicating herself in the murder of her husband, Judge Moreland officially stopped the hearing and read her the Miranda rights himself. I'm going to pause now to hear a final word from today's sponsors. What guilty pleasures have you guys been into lately? With all this cold weather, I've been loving curling up with a fun whodunit book like Magpie Murders. It's such a fun read, but page turners can be a time suck. I feel guilty when I've got so much work to do. But playing Best Fiends is guilt-free. It's an endless source of fun right on my phone that I can play anytime and anywhere. It's a match 3 puzzle game with literally thousands of levels and new content added all the time. I especially love playing Best Fiends after writing or recording. It's not just a mindless game to pass the time, but a satisfying challenge that helps me get out of my own head for a while. I've been playing Best Fiends for a year now, and I've made it to level 770. My new favorite fiend is named Whisper, and I use her almost every time. And I'm loving the new challenge to collect water cans to get prizes like gold and keys. Best Fiends is boredom's worst nightmare. There's something new today, tomorrow, and every day after that. There are literally thousands of levels to play and so many cute characters to collect. Download Best Fiends free today on the Apple App Store or Google Play. That's friends without the R, Best Fiends. Is there something bothering you? I know sometimes my anxiety can make me just freeze up. It interferes with my productivity. BetterHelp Online Counseling is there for us. They will assess your needs and match you with your own licensed professional therapist. BetterHelp has over 3,000 licensed therapists in all 50 states, treating depression, anxiety, stress, trauma, grief, and other issues that so many of us suffer from. In fact, so many people have been using BetterHelp that they are recruiting additional counselors in all 50 states. The service is also available to clients worldwide. From your phone, laptop, or tablet, you can connect with a professional counselor via text, chat, phone, or video, and start communicating with your counselor in under 24 hours. You can send a message to your counselor at any time. You'll get timely and thoughtful responses, and you can schedule weekly sessions with your counselor by video or phone, whichever makes you feel more comfortable. BetterHelp is committed to facilitating great therapeutic matches, so it is easy and free to change counselors if you want to, and anything you share is confidential. BetterHelp is more affordable than traditional offline counseling, and there is even financial aid available. I want you to start living a happier life today. As a listener, you'll get 10% off your first month by visiting betterhelp.com/southern. Join over 1 million people taking charge of their mental health. Again, that's betterhelp, HELP.com/southern. Based on the recommendation of the judge, investigators took a closer look into Martha's story and her possible participation in the murder. They checked her and Jeff's phone records for the days leading up to his murder and found something interesting in the call logs. According to the records, a call was made to Hazel Freeman, Jeff's mother, around 11 p.m. on the night he died. At first glance, this wasn't unusual, as police learned that Jeff always called his mom at 11 p.m. on Sundays. But when investigators spoke to Hazel, they learned that it was actually Martha who had made the routine call that night. Hazel reported to the Tennessean that the call did not seem out of place and that Martha was, quote, as happy as a lark. Martha had informed Hazel Freeman that Jeff was ill and that she had given him some medicine. She claimed that Jeff had gone to bed early to get some sleep and wouldn't be up for a call that night. During their investigation, law enforcement learned that while Martha was supposedly in shock and fear and sitting with her husband's body throughout Sunday evening and Monday morning, she was actually out running errands. According to trial testimony, she picked up a prescription at her local Walgreens at 10 p.m., which was confirmed by a pharmacy tech. Other errands, including her leaving her home at least two times during the morning on Monday to walk the dog and smoke a cigarette. Investigators felt that Martha had ample opportunity to get away from Rafael Rocha Perez and to call the police. 4 months later, in August of 2005, Martha Freeman was arrested and charged for the murder of her husband. Martha posted bail shortly after her arrest, despite the $75,000 bond. On September 1st, 2005, as Martha awaited trial, police were called to her home. The Tennessean reported that police received an alert from the Vanderbilt Psychiatric Hospital that Martha had taken 60 Xanax pills and other types of medication in an apparent suicide attempt. When police got to the house, they found Martha to be coherent and capable of movement, but still called for an ambulance to transport her to the hospital. On September 26, 2006, Martha Freeman and Rafael Rocha Perez went on trial together for the murder of Jeffrey Freeman, even though their attorneys vehemently objected and wanted separate trials. The judge in the case determined that the kinkier details about Martha's sex life could not be mentioned. Specifically, the jury did not hear about Martha's night of partying with Rafael and his two friends. The prosecutor in the case, Katie Miller, asserted that Martha had helped orchestrate and commit the murder, insisting that the real motive was money. According to the prosecution, Martha knew she wouldn't be able to get the business or provide for herself financially if the marriage ended in divorce. Miller pointed to the emails uncovered by investigators, and the fuzzy timeline did not match the story that Martha had given law enforcement. The prosecution also referenced the beach towel that had been found spread out on the floor in the living room of the home, the towel that investigators originally believed had been used by Rocha Perez in the cleanup. The beach towel was tested, and it was found to have DNA from Martha and sperm from Rocha Perez on it. At some point, as Jeffrey Freeman lay dead upstairs, Martha and Rafael had sex on that towel. Resifax employee Tara Cantrell testified during the trial that on the morning of April 11, 2005, between 8 and 8:30 a.m., she received a call at the office from Martha Freeman. During the call, Martha told her that Jeff would not be coming to the office that day as he was sick. Tara Cantrell testified that while on the phone with Martha, nothing seemed strange and that Martha seemed normal. Martha's defense, led by attorney Rich McGee, was open about her sexual transgressions and the affair, calling it immoral conduct. McGee addressed the jury and said, quote, "A lot of people have affairs, but affairs don't lead to murder." Her defense claimed that Jeff's murder had been the result of jealousy between the two men in her life over Martha's affection, the cliched love triangle I spoke of in the beginning of the episode. But Rafael's attorney argued that Martha had killed her husband on her own to avoid a drawn-out and messy divorce, and she had decided to pin the murder on his client. He asked the jurors, quote, "Who better to blame it on than someone who is here illegally?" He also cross-examined one of the officers on the scene that was in charge of processing items of interest within the home. According to the officer, he had processed the shotgun found in the home and found no latent prints. Martha had originally told her neighbor and police that the man in her house who killed her husband had a shotgun. Linda Wilson, a fingerprint examiner from the Metro Police Department, testified that she was able to recover latent prints on a Playboy magazine, Penthouse magazine, and a Dr. Pepper can, all matching Rahael's prints, but the prints weren't on the shotgun. The assistant medical examiner on the case, Dr. Thomas Deering, focused his testimony on the binding marks found on Jeffrey's wrists. According to Deering, Jeffrey Freeman had been alive and was likely struggling against the binds as he fought for his life. He suggested that it must have taken two people to subdue the 200-plus-pound man, but he admitted that he was ultimately unable to determine exactly how many people were involved in the attack. During cross-examination from Freeman's defense team, Dr. Deering described the numerous injuries that Jeff had sustained, including between 4 to 7 blows to the head and ligature marks around his neck. The pre-taped testimony of Hazel Freeman, Jeff's mom, was played for the jurors. In the video, she discussed how Martha had called her on the night of Sunday, April 10th, telling her that she had given Jeff medicine and he had gone to bed. The prosecution pointed out that Jeffrey Freeman's autopsy revealed that he had no such medicine in his system at the time of his death. The prosecution theorized that after Martha and Rahael murdered Jeff, they placed his body into the sleeping bag before they realized they weren't capable of getting his body down the several flights of stairs it would take to get it outside of the home. Martha's longtime employee, Tony Cantrell, was called to the stand. He talked about how he was scheduled to arrive at the Freeman home later in the day on Monday, April 11th, to refinish the back deck. The prosecution said that running out of time, Martha changed her plans of disposing of the body and instead shifted to a new plan, to pretend that there had been a home invasion. She just had not counted on the other neighbor seeing Rahael run into the house that was under construction close by. In their closing, Martha's defense pointed out that everything presented by the prosecution and Rahel's defense were all theories, and emphasized that there was sufficient reasonable doubt that Martha had played a role in her husband's death. The prosecution referenced the beach towel again, stating, quote, "Maybe the sex on the towel, on the floor in the living room, was to celebrate the fact that they had just murdered Jeffrey." The jury had so much to consider in this case, especially that three different arguments were proposed in the courtroom. The prosecution, of course, had argued that Martha and Rahael acted together to kill Jeff, and that their plan had fallen apart. Rahael's defense argued that there was no physical evidence in the case, and that despite the threat of the police, Rahael had no reason to murder Jeff, and did not even have a criminal record in the United States or in Mexico. Martha's defense team argued that Rahael had murdered Jeffrey Freeman out of jealousy, and that Martha had simply been another victim who was too stunned and scared to notify the police. Even though they had so many details to review, on September 28, 2006, the jury returned a verdict within just 2 hours. They found both Martha Freeman and Rahael Rocha Perez guilty of first-degree murder in the case of Jeffrey Freeman. They were both automatically sentenced to life in prison, which in the state of Tennessee means 51 years in prison before they would be considered eligible for parole. In 2008, both Freeman and Rocha Perez appealed their convictions. Martha stated that the court erred by allowing the nude photograph of Rahael to be entered as evidence, and by refusing to let her sever her trial and case from her ex-lovers. Rahael also stated in his appeal that the court erred by not allowing him to sever his case from Martha's. Upon review, both of the appeals were struck down. In 2014, Martha submitted another appeal, arguing that her lawyers, Glenn Funk and Rich McGee, did not effectively represent her. In part, this appeal was made because Funk suggested that Martha go through with the trial instead of taking a plea deal that Rich McGee had arranged. The plea would have resulted in a 20-year sentence with the possibility of parole after just 6 years, as long as Martha had testified against Rocha Perez and assisted with the state's case against her former lover. Glenn Funk may have advised his client to go to trial, but not taking the deal was Martha's decision. On March 31, 2014, the appeal was rejected. If Martha had taken the deal, she likely would have been out of prison by 2012, but instead, she will not be eligible for parole until the year 2064. She gambled with her life, and she lost. She had either sat by and listened to her husband being beaten and strangled, or she had participated in the attack. We will never know the real truth because Martha is a liar. Jeffrey Freeman was a well-loved, hard-working man and a dedicated husband. He not only stood by his wife, he supported her, concerned for her mental health and just wanting her to get better. He did double the work at their business so she could stay home and take care of herself. And he continued to try and make his marriage work, even after he found out about Martha's affair. But Martha took advantage of her husband's kindness and love and created a life for herself, based on her own words, that was just like the lives of the women on Desperate Housewives. She reduced her husband's life to a salacious love triangle headline. She was egotistical enough to think a jury would believe her. And since she won't be eligible for parole until she is 100 years old, she will probably die in prison. Southern Fried True Crime is produced by me, Erica Kelly. Today's episode was researched and written by Hannah Newcomb, with additional research, writing, and editing by me. The audio is edited and engineered by Ches Gray of Gray Multimedia. Southern Fried's original music is by Rob Harrison of Gamma Radio, and the original graphic art is by Coley Horner. And thank you to listener Rachel Bannister for suggesting today's episode. If you're not already a member, come join my Facebook group. While we do discuss crime, we also share memes and have a lot of laughs. We worship our patron saint, Dolly Parton, and our motto is, no shit ass is allowed. If you enjoyed today's show, don't forget to subscribe and please tell a friend or rate and review on iTunes. I'm also on most large platforms like Stitcher and Spotify, as well as Stitcher Premium, where you can listen ad-free. If you have any case suggestions, please email southernfriedtruecrime@gmail.com. I do not accept case suggestions on social media private messages, but please feel free to reach out by email. Not only do I get my most interesting and little-known cases from listener suggestions, I love hearing from you guys. Until next time, thanks so much for listening. Y'all take care.